Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to talk about our faith in institutions. So, I'd like to talk, at least begin our conversation today by talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. And the reason is not really because of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. The Rittenhouse trial is a symptom of what's wrong in this country and has, because it is symptomatic and emblematic, it's caught our attention and it's become the focus of many, especially on the political right in this country, because it seems to them to be a clear-cut case of political prosecution. And it's with very good reason that the conservatives are concerned that this is a political prosecution. If you haven't been following the trial, let's do a brief review of the facts in lieu of reading a news article so that we can make sense of why there is such a furor over this trial. Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial for murder because during the Kenosha riots, the Kenosha peaceful protests, Kyle went to defend businesses and offered first aid to people who had been injured. During the night, he was attacked. This is not alleged. It's on video. He was attacked. Guns were fired. And according to both witness testimony and video evidence, young Kyle only fired after he was attacked by people who had physically assaulted him with a skateboard and a gun. Again, after at least one shot had been fired while he was being chased by a group of peaceful protesters. Now, if you think that this is a textbook case of self-defense and that it's ludicrous that this case is even being tried, then you would side with a huge number of legal scholars who have been saying for days that the judge should issue a directed verdict, meaning that the judge doesn't even let the case go to a jury, but he enters the verdict of not guilty himself because no reasonable jury could find otherwise. Again, if you haven't been following the trial, this may sound like I'm blowing things out of proportion, but the case is going so badly for the prosecution that some legal commentators are actually suggesting that the prosecution is deliberately throwing the case and possibly acting unethically to try to get a mistrial so they can possibly retry later. Most recently, at least as of the time I'm recording this, and mind you, this is after, what I'm going to mention here is after the prosecution's star witness, prosecution's key witnesses. What I'm going to say in the future is after the prosecution's key witness, after he said that Rittenhouse only shot him after he had pointed a handgun at Rittenhouse. After. Now, after that little bit of legal theater, the prosecutor had Rittenhouse answering questions, and it was like watching a tragicomedy when someone who isn't a lawyer is forced through some kind of Freaky Friday body-switching magic where somebody who has zero legal training and knowledge is forced to become a, you know, prosecutor for the district attorney's office. It's almost as though you're watching like a remake of Freaky Friday, except instead of Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, now it's this guy who maybe has like switched places with his 9-year-old son. And, you know, like, so the prosecutor's running around, like, going to class and, like, trying to get his teachers to listen to him and say, you know, our bodies have been switched. And the 9-year-old is, like, having to go to court and prosecute the case. And so his dad, who's actually now in the 9-year-old body, is, like, sending text messages to him, like, ask this question, don't ask this question, you know. And it's supposed to be comical and funny, except it's not funny because there's a young man who's actually on trial for murder and could get life in prison. It's like watching that. It really is that bad. He was asking Rittenhouse if he played the Call of Duty video game, which is, of course, deeply relevant to whether he was acting in self-defense. He asked Rittenhouse why he thought he needed to shoot Grosskreutz when Grosskreutz was pointing a gun at him because, you know, Kyle had a rifle and Grosskreutz only had a handgun. Yeah, he actually asked that. And to top it all off, he asked Rittenhouse why he had been silent and hadn't talked to the media until the trial, which he did, of course, to insinuate Rittenhouse's silence was evidence of his guilt. Now, I'm no legal scholar. I've never even been to law school. I don't even watch cop dramas, so I'm not an expert. But I have read the Constitution a few times, and the last I checked, in this country, you have a right to remain silent, and that silence cannot be interpreted as an admission of guilt. Moreover, people who actually are legal experts, including the judge, have said that asking a defendant this question is a major no-no. Like first-year legal stuff that every lawyer knows, kind of no-no. You simply cannot ask that question because you risk the judge dismissing with prejudice, which means that he can't be tried again. Now, this is especially relevant because Judge Schrader has apparently often spoken out about how he thinks the media craze for information is poisoning juries before trials, and prosecutors are getting cases tried in the media before they ever make it to court. And I'm inclined to agree with the judge. I think it's getting very hard in this country to get a fair trial. But the fact that this prosecutor would ask the question, knowing that it's 1, unethical, 2, stupid, 3, sticking a finger in the judge's sore spot, and 4, possibly illegal... The fact that he would ask this question is truly mind-boggling. And so people following this case are saying that the Kenosha DA brought a case that never should have been brought in, and that the prosecutor is engaged in misconduct. And the thing is that there have been corrupt and crappy prosecutors and district attorneys for a long time. That's not new. And that's not particularly disturbing. I mean, it is disturbing, but it's a correctable bug. What's worrying isn't so much the crappy behavior of the lawyer in the trial, it's the fact that this looks very much like a selective prosecution. It looks very much like Kyle Rittenhouse is only on trial because it is politically expedient for the DA to try him. All over the country, the major media were calling him a murderer and a racist and a white supremacist. The BLM and Antifa thugs and terrorists, I mean peaceful protesters, were threatening to burn Kenosha again if Kyle weren't tried and found guilty. Which, by the way, is like the literal definition of terrorism, you know, the use of or terrorizing threat of violence to achieve political ends. So we either have a criminal justice system too frightened of the race-baiting communist terrorists to oppose them or in league with them, and I'm not sure which is worse. But this is all in line with everything we've been seeing. From the government, we see the FBI has become little more than a progressive political enforcement brigade, which is neat to see the FBI go back to its roots, you know, back in the day when it was little more than Hoover's personal blackmail network. You know, it's like a kind of a hashtag remember where you came from, remember your roots type thing, you know. Also, recently the FBI raided the homes of Project Veritas reporters because they apparently were in possession of Ashley Biden's stolen, in quotes, diary, and therefore they were in possession of stolen goods. Notice how the New York Times wasn't raided when they received Donald Trump's stolen tax returns. We see that the raid and the data extraction being done by the FBI was so egregious that a federal judge halted their work. Of course, you know, we know that the IRS under Obama was targeting political opponents, and now we're seeing history repeat with the bureaucratic agency attacks on conservative groups and individuals as the government wants to start monitoring all transactions over $600. And this is disquieting. But it's all the more upsetting when we see that corrupt government bureaucrats and agents are not only abusing their power, but that the apparatchiks are in bed with big business to have a joint public-private progressive platform to ensure that the only people who have the rights to free speech and privacy and conscience and trial by jury are the people who fit the mold. Business and bureaucracy are united in bringing in the secular millennium. And I say millennium and not utopia because this vision is clearly a religious and theological vision and not merely a socio-political one. As if the theological could ever be removed from the political anyways, but that's neither here nor there. The problem is not that our institutions are godless. The problem is that they worship the wrong gods. It isn't a lack of theology, it's a bad theology, and a bad theology is always opposed to good theology. Indeed, bad theology cannot tolerate good theology, and when men whose theology is bad are in charge, they will persecute those who have good theology. Today, I want us to consider the account of Joash, the king of Judah. Now, if you have a good Bible memory, you'll remember that Joash was a little boy who was likely to be put to death by the wicked queen Athaliah, who took over after her son was killed by Jehu. The godly priest Jehoiada took Joash and hid him until the king was no longer a baby and Jehoiada had gathered enough strength and political power. Then he had Athaliah deposed and Joash was made king. And as long as Jehoiada was around, Joash listened to him and did what was right. But then he decided to forget God, and we're given the story in 2 Chronicles chapter 24. After the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened to them. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their ancestors, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Because of their guilt, God's anger came on Judah and Jerusalem. Although the Lord sent prophets to the people to bring them back to him, and though they testified against them, they would not listen. Then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, son of Jehoiada the priest. He stood before the people and said, "This is what God says. Why do you disobey the Lord's command? You will not prosper, because you have forsaken the Lord. He has forsaken you." But they plotted against him, and by order of the king, they stoned him to death in the courtyard of the Lord's temple. King Joash did not remember the kindness Zechariah's father Jehoiada had shown him, but killed his son, who said as he lay dying, "May the Lord see this and call you to account." At the turn of the year, the army of Aram marched against Joash and invaded Judah and Jerusalem and killed all the leaders of the people. They sent all the plunder to their king in Damascus. Although the Aramean army had come with only a few men, the Lord delivered into their hands a much larger army. Because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their ancestors, judgment was executed on Joash. When the Arameans withdrew, they left Joash severely wounded. His officials conspired against him for murdering the son of Jehoiada the priest, and they killed him in his bed. So he died and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. Those who conspired against him were Zabad, son of Chimeath, an Ammonite woman, and Jehozabad, son of Shimrith, a Moabite woman. The account of his sons, the many prophecies about him, and the record of the restoration of the temple are written in the annotations on the book of the kings, and Amaziah his son succeeded him as king. Later, we read that Amaziah, the son of the prophet-murdering King Joash, was also confronted by a prophet. Let's take a look at that in 2 Chronicles chapter 25. When Amaziah returned from slaughtering the Edomites, he brought back the gods of the people of Seir. He set them up as his own gods, bowed down to them, and burned sacrifices to them. The anger of the Lord burned against Amaziah, and he sent a prophet to him who said, "Why do you consult this people's gods, which could not save their own people from your hand?" While he was still speaking, the king said to him, "Have we appointed you an advisor to the king? Stop! Why be struck down?" So the prophet stopped and said, "I know that God has determined to destroy you, because you have done this and have not listened to my counsel." And since God isn't a liar, King Amaziah was destroyed because he decided to challenge Jehoash, Jehu's grandson, in the powerful northern kingdom, and he got himself killed. Now, these two stories may seem random. They are not. Notice what happens in the story. The idol worshippers in power, when challenged, they overthrow law and justice, and they try to silence opposition through intimidation and murder. And while these are, of course, only two examples of many we could find of this kind of behavior in the Bible, it's important to note that both of these events, the murder of Zechariah, son of Jehoiada, and the threat to murder the unnamed prophet who challenged Amaziah, both of them came about before these kings were destroyed. Because bad theology doesn't work. Bad theology is always its own undoing. Those who reject God's wisdom and murder and threaten his prophets have to suffer for their wickedness and folly. Friends, the way of the transgressor is hard because God is not mocked. Every man reaps what he sows. When people sow lies and corruption and violence, then they reap destruction. And in nations whose politicians and police and prosecutors and presidents are a pack of lying heretics, that nation is doomed. Now, if you're listening to me right now and saying that seeing kids railroaded and investigative journalists' homes raided and the FBI lying on FISA warrants and big tech oligarchs silencing free speech and the myriad other events that have happened in the past few years and that they've eroded our public trust in institutions, you're hearing me right. That is what I'm saying. If you hear me say that and you expect me to say that the solution is a return to the Constitution and rural values and some kind of Cato-like classical liberal virtues in society, then your expectations are sadly out of line with reality. Because I have no intention of saying all we need to do is to be more American, that we need more free speech, and that we need to get rid of corruption in the courts, and we need to rein in the power of the technocrats. I have no intention of saying it because, one, it isn't true, and two, it wouldn't work. It isn't true because thinking that all we need to do is read the Federalist Papers and some Ayn Rand and start baking apple pie again, it misses the point. It ignores how we got here in the first place. The kind of rah-rah, let's go Brandon kind of Americans think that they can restore the country by fixing the manifested corruption in our systems, but they have no idea why that corruption exists. Progressives don't become utopians because they're progressive. Utopians become progressives because they're utopian. And utopians are utopian because they have rejected the living and true God, and they have believed in false gods. They have ignored the theological truths of God's sovereignty, God's laws, and human depravity, and they've followed lies of their own making. Indeed, they hate the truth, and they reject the truth, and they hate you for believing the truth. And the problem in this country is that our institutions are run by progressives who are utopian millenarians who are opposed to God. Let me repeat, just in case you didn't get it. The reason why we're seeing all of this corruption, the real reason is because there is a theological conflict between Christians and people who hold to traditional Christian values and those who are progressive utopians. That's the war right now. That's the battle. That's the fight. And over the next few weeks, I want us to explore this idea. I want us to try to understand why utopianism is the worldview of the God-haters and why it is incompatible with Christianity and what Christians need to do in response to it. So I hope you'll join us then, next week and the weeks that follow, for more exciting episodes of Truth in Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day. To His glory.